Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the second of the series of How It Works tutorials. We first started this in Buenos Aires. These tutorials are intended to provide ICANN meeting attendees with a better understanding of the various components of sort of the ecosystem in which we operate and the technologies that are used for the Internet system of unique identifiers. This first tutorial will be provided by Paul Hoffman, who is a new hire into ICANN. He actually works for me in the office of the CTO. Oh, I should probably say I'm David Conrad, ICANN CTO. I have worked to create these How It Works tutorials for the community. And Paul has graciously offered to provide this session on the Internet Engineering Task Force. In Buenos Aires, a similar presentation was provided by Russ Housley of the IETF IAB, or his own company, VigilSec. Paul joined us, what? July 1st, and has volunteered to provide this tutorial, and I hope you find it valuable. And that quick introduction, I will now throw it over to Paul.
Good. So Russ is actually here this week, in case you see him. So if you were at the Buenos Aires meeting, these slides are very similar to what you saw before. It's not worth necessarily seeing, but I've modified them some. But it's based on the work that Russ did. So I've been active in the IETF for more than 20 years, sort of my background for giving this. We've got 90 minutes on time. So if, as I'm going, have a question that you think is immediate right then, feel free to ask. You know, raise your hand. We've got a roving mic. I will try to answer some then. I might answer by saying, don't worry, that 4 slides from now. But feel free to ask. If that's not working, like if I'm running behind, which I should be following, then I might ask you to stop asking questions until the end so that we really will have 15 minutes. So if you're the kind of person who really wants to ask a fuller question at the end, definitely take notes. If you want to ask in the middle, that's fine. So again, what this is about is the IETF, which is not part of ICANN. ICANN is not part of the IETF. This is an introduction so that you'll understand the relationship between the two groups, which is fairly tight. Very good. So this is a chart that ISOC, the Internet Society, which I'll discuss later, prepared a few years ago, which describes the entire Internet ecosystem. And you can see that there are lots and lots of parts of the entire Internet ecosystem. The thing that's most relevant here is the fact that there are lots and lots of parts. It's not ICANN. It's not the IETF. There are all sorts of things. So the URL for this is in the bottom of the slides. If later you want to actually go through it, it's probably the best chart I've seen that describes everything. What we're going to be talking about today is the orange oval. And in that orange oval, we've got three groups. The IETF, which is the main topic for today. The IAB, the Internet Architecture Board, and I've got a couple of slides on that. And the third thing, which is hard to read because, of course, there's a million things up there, in that orange oval is the IRTF, which is the Internet Research Task Force. The IRTF, which I'm not going to be describing in other slides, the IRTF is related to the IETF and the IAB. They often meet at the same time, but it really is very, very researchy. They don't make standard. They don't have a whole lot of process going on. It's really meant for academics and serious research. But since they sort of come under the same IETF umbrella, they're funded through the same way that the IETF is, and there's not so many of them. It's sort of like a little adjunct. They get put into here. If anyone here is more of a researcher, academic and such like that, you would be interested in the IRTF. But like I say, I'm not going to be describing that much today. So really, of this whole ecosystem, what we are covering today is just that one little bit over there. But there's plenty to cover. One of the things that people are most concerned with when they come in, they say, well, why is all of happening now? You know, it's 2015 and there's this whole environment going on. Well, had you asked that question 20 years ago in 1995, there would be some of these pieces here, but not that many. And the IETF would have been the main center of where the work was being done. That was before ICANN existed. The ICANN sort of came out of work that, of procedural work that many people in the IETF did and such. But the IETF greatly precedes all of that. So that's mostly what we'll be talking about today. I've got a couple of ways of saying what the IETF does. Here's the first one. So in this talk right now, I'm going to cover why. You know, why does the IETF do what it does? And so really that little short, we make the net work, that sounds a little bit glib, but it's actually quite accurate. And it has been accurate for the last 30 years. That is, when you think about where networking was, I can tell some people in the room maybe not even aren't even 30. So, you know, but for those of us old timers who remember the net in the late 80s, in the early 90s, it was very fragmented. The internet was part of that, but it was considered a weird part of that. At, you know, as the IETF was starting up, there was generally a feeling that networks, kinds of networks, should stay separate. We don't want to be part of that one over. The IETF flipped that on its head, and the main mission of the IETF from day one was, if you wanted a network that was a network of networks, that was going to be inclusive, that was going to include almost everybody who wanted to participate, unless they were, for example, ambitious, but pretty much anyone else, how would you create that? What kind of engineering needs to go into that? And so that's why the IETF started. Humorously, it hasn't changed that much in the why. That original feeling is still the same. Now, we don't think of it as much because in the last 15, 20 years, the internet pretty much took over all of networking. You don't really think of people saying, oh, I'm going to set up my own network that's not connected to the internet. That's just really rare. But historically, that was, in fact, the way the world was. Especially in the mid-80s, what you had were networks who differentiated themselves by saying, oh, we don't touch those funny things over there, for any value of those funny things. CompuServe was a private network that didn't want to interact with some of its competitors. It wanted to be an independent silo. But the IETF looked at this all and said, you know, you're all going to come around to the right idea eventually, and they did. But that whole feeling of why start something like this came from that. So the main mission really was, how do we make an environment where that's going to be possible? Well, we need to have documentation. We need to have good engineering. We need to have some sort of policies. But again, when this all started in the mid-80s, we didn't really know what the future would look like. And by the way, I'm saying we here. I did not get active in the IETF until the mid-90s, but started the IETF, knew what they wanted. They knew some ways to start getting there, but they didn't really know what it was going to end up like. So this is the why. I'll have a couple of other why slides sort of sprinkled throughout. Most of this discussion today is going to be the how the IETF works, how you can work with the IETF. But it's important to remember the why, because especially if you're a person who has come into the internet in the last 20 years, you may not remember that the world was not destined to be this way. When the IETF started, as the IETF started to become popular, many of the organizers of these other networks were openly ridiculing the IETF for being a bunch of socialist hippies, of not understanding how the world would really work, that no one really wants to have that much interaction with no. And specifically, some of the ridicule came from folks like in the ITU who said permissionless interaction with a network is dangerous. No one's going to want that. Of course, we don't hear that anymore. But I wanted to emphasize the why here actually has, you know, a fair amount of things. So this is one of the mottos that you will hear a fair amount, that we reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code. This is highly prized in the IETF. It's not always adhered to, but so a couple of things that come from this that you should note is, one thing is, in the IETF there's no voting. I'll talk a little bit more about that. And if there's no voting, you have to at some point figure out, when are we done on this decision? And so the idea of rough consensus, I have a presentation on rough consensus. The last little bit here of running code, a very engineering-ish thing. It's not always true. In fact, sometimes the IETF standardizes things without running code. And sometimes they discover after they've finished standardizing it that it doesn't actually work, because when someone wrote code, they discovered it didn't work. But in general, having running code for things that you're working on, whether it's an actual protocol or even a process, is considered very valuable in the IETF. And Dave Clark said this umpty-ump years ago, maybe 25, I don't think it was quite 30 years ago. But the idea here is that, and you'll see this as we go through some of the following slides, is that the IETF really doesn't care about hearing from on high what people want. You know, so a very important person comes in and says, oh, no, you shouldn't do that. The fact that they're a very important person pretty much doesn't mean much to folks in the IETF. Now, if they can show in a technical way why you don't want to do that, great. But the IETF, more than most organizations you would expect, tends to actually, I mean, David used the word reject here, reject the idea that if you walk and say, I'm very important and you should do this, usually that's more of a cause for laughter than it is for respect. If you come in saying, hi, I've really looked at this, here's my analysis, this is why I think you should do this, then you get a lot more respect. So how does one become an IETF participant? So this is a quote from an RFC. I'll talk a little bit more later about what RFCs are, and the RFCs are all numbered. So from RFC 4677, that because it's a loosely controlled group, it's self-organized, anyone can really be a participant. So that first bullet point, everyone is invited to participate, is absolutely true. I mean, I see a number of people here in the room. I won't ask everyone to raise their hand, but anyone in the room who can raise their hand can be a participant in the IETF. I'm not saying you all want, many folks here are probably not primarily technical. The IETF is a primarily tech organization. But if you're in this room right now, you might be technically oriented, and you might find a group of other technically oriented people interesting. You can be a participant. And when I say can be, I mean literally that's all it takes is interest. You get on a mailing list, and you are a participant in the IETF. There are no fees. There is no membership requirement. That just happens. It really is an open community. And being an open community, it's a very international community. From day one, the IETF, even though many people come from the United States, was international. That is, the leadership of the IETF in the very first year included Europeans and Asians, which was also considered a little bit radical in the mid-'80s. In the mid-'80s, a lot of these organizations that were starting up to talk about networking were very national. Or maybe it might be like the European this, but the IETF started off, you know, with a bunch of academics and researchers going, hey, there are people all over the world who are studying networking. So, sure, why wouldn't we do this? And email is international, and since one of the primary ways that the IETF does its work is through email, sure, we'll just start off with this, which bothered a fair number of people as well, because they were like, well, how do I know if that person from that country is representing the government or not? Turns out the IETF is really against representation. So the third bullet point, it's interested individuals, not companies. That could probably even say not organizations, not governments or whatever. If you show up on a mailing list with your technical, you may be from Google, you may be from the government of Spain or whatever. People don't actually care where you're from that much. They really care what you're bringing. And a good way to see this, by the way, is because some companies are very heavily represented in the IETF. For example, Cisco, the router maker, has hundreds of Cisco employees who are there. They don't speak for Cisco. If you want to see one of the funnier things is go on to one of the routing discussions and watch Cisco people argue with each other, not only about the Telomeris, but about what's a good idea or not. So, that's a good way to really get a feeling for this doesn't happen. The same happens with countries. Sometimes people will say, oh, the Chinese are not going to want this. And someone from China will say, well, I don't know who you're talking about. I'm Chinese. I think it's just fine. Or vice versa. So the representation part, sure, we all spend our time on this, unless it's a hobby, coming from someplace. That's not how you get paid attention to in the IETF at all. So really the goal is rough consensus, and the way we get there is by doing it mostly that you participate remotely. The IETF meets 3 times a year, which is where ICANN got the magic of 3 times a year. But as you'll see in later slides, you don't have to go to IETF meetings at all to be very, very effective. Most of the work is done on the mailing lists, and there are a number of people who have made very important standards in the IETF who have not ever shown up to a meeting or showed up for a meeting, lost their travel funding or whatever, and have continued to be extremely important in the IETF and have not shown up in over a decade. So let's talk a little bit about the rough consensus thing, because this is very weird, right? Voting is easy. Everything else gets a little bit funky. So because there is no defined membership, remember in the last slide I just said, you could be a member today, right? And you don't have to sign up and there's whatever. How would you have voting if you don't know who are the people who can vote? So the idea of rough consensus has been part of the ethos of the IETF since the very beginning. One of the very important things is not only is there no voting, but you don't need to be unanimous ever. There are plenty of technical topics where there's going to be a small minority who are going to disagree with the way something's going. If there is rough consensus of the group, then it moves forwards. Sometimes the IETF will do things that look a little bit like voting, and they'll say, well, who wants this, and hands will be raised. But that's usually just to get a feeling for how much more do we need to discuss this. So there's 20, 25 people in the room right now. If I said right now, who understands this, and say 20 of you raised your hand, that gives me a sense of, oh, okay, I can probably move on. 10 of you raise your hand, I get the sense of, oh, I need to keep going on this. That's very, very much what happened. And remember, since the IETF only meets 3 times a year, and yet progress gets made at other times, on a mailing list, when the working group chair might say, how are we doing on this? They have no idea what the percentage is. They'll have a feeling for when they say, and this is how you get rough consensus, who's sort of against this? No one speaks up. They say, okay, we can move forwards. Or a couple people speak up. Or some people say, I don't know what we're doing. That's how you get to rough consensus. So disputes here are really resolved by discussion. And even with a face-to-face meeting, so there is a face-to-face meeting, some decisions seem to get made. Decisions are never finalized at the meeting. They're always taken back to the mailing list later. Usually it's okay, but sometimes people who weren't at a face-to-face meeting really do get to say, no, this didn't really go the way that I thought that it would because this didn't get described. And there's if the topic of rough consensus is of interest to you, there's a recent RFC on that that is actually pretty fascinating. The result of what the IETF does is open. And again, I want to emphasize that the idea of open standards is a recent idea. Even by 1993. There were many organizations who were not the IETF who were very, very, very against the idea of open standards. Came out and said any standards the IETF does cannot be legitimate because anyone can get at them. Of course, those people have all sort of, fallen off. But no one who's doing an open standard, because it's open, can say, oh, well, we can enforce this. There isn't an enforcement group. It really is an open standard. Open means you are welcome to adopt it. If you want to do things on the open internet, you probably need to adopt this in order to interact, because other people will say, no, we aren't going to be able to communicate with y'all if you don't do this. But in fact, there's no internet police in the sense of saying you must follow this specific standard. So when there's consensus about this, it becomes an open standard. It can change later. There's no one who says, oh, you must do it till this time, you know, until later. So the IETF's idea of the open standards was sort of weird, sort of radical, but it is the way that things have worked since then. And pretty much every other standards group has had to adopt it because of the popularity of the internet. Not everyone has. For example, some standards group make you pay money in order to see their standards. They make you pay money in order to say that you're using their standards. IETF never has, never will. So let's talk a little bit more. The next few slides are going to come back into the how does the IETF work. And the way that work starts to happen in the IETF is that someone writes an internet draft. And when I say somebody, I mean it could be any of you in this room as well. You do not have to be an IETF member in order to write an internet draft. And in fact, we regularly see internet drafts written by people who no one has really even seen say anything on a mailing list. So an internet draft is really, really just a proposal. It is not something that is at all finalized. The idea of an internet draft, you know, and this started really early in the IETF culture, is that the first thing that someone proposes about something new is likely to be rough and possibly flat out wrong. That's okay. We would rather have it said. We would rather have it said in public rather than private work go on and then everyone thinks it's, you know, and then only brought out when they. So I want to emphasize here, if you look at an internet draft and you go, oh my God, this is terrible, that's just fine. We hope that it doesn't progress. But the fact that someone wrote an internet draft that has a really bad idea in it is actually a positive thing. And I say this as somebody who has written some internet drafts where I put them out and people are just like, ooh, did you not think of this enough? That's fine, because what you want is somebody to be able to say, that doesn't look right, this looks right. And then either, like, if I agree with them, I'll just modify and I'll do another version. Drafts go through many versions. Again, that's a little bit hard for some people because they're a little bit embarrassed about saying things that are wrong. And so we don't get as many internet drafts as we might hope for. But in fact, this process of try something, just go ahead and get it published, let everyone see it. And you folks can, you know, again, just like all documents in the IETF, internet drafts are completely open for reading. It's a way to get things started. RFCs, the things that people have come to agreement on, come later. And I've got some slides on RFCs. This is a little bit of a digression about the format. The internet drafts and RFC format, they're all in English. We need to have some language that everyone will understand. And we've considered at times going multilingual, and it's turned out the translation of technical material generally doesn't work very well, especially if there's supposed to be universal understanding of it. So the IETF has stayed with English, not that it wants to be in English, but that seems to work the best. This is a sore point for me, but we're still using ASCII text for all of our drafts, which means that people with names that are not pretty much English names are stuck right now. That's changing. We're moving to XML, like this says. We'll have full internationalization. I would have hoped that it had happened by now. It'll happen next year, and I'm hoping that next year really is next year, that it's not the rolling next year that we're all used to. But for now, it's still just ugly ASCII text. It looks like on a line printer from the 80s, and in fact, you can. Now, the flip side of my complaint is the fact that after 44 years of RFCs, you can actually still go back and read RFC numbers. Everyone can. Some standards organizations picked like Microsoft Word as a format and such, and you can't actually read the old Microsoft Word document. You can actually still read everything that the IETF has published. So that's a positive thing. So let's talk a little bit about what happens when something becomes an RFC. These are the numbers of RFCs published each year, and just for reference, shows when the IETF actually formed. So there were RFCs written before the IETF was formed. A bunch of researchers had gotten together just informally and said, this is how we think the networking should work. But the IETF formed pretty much in the mid-80s, and that's the first arrow. And then ICANN about a decade and a half later, second arrow. These are the total numbers of RFCs, not RFCs about the DNS. The number of RFCs in the DNS is much smaller than this. It's a large number. It's over 100. But it's not. We're not getting hundreds a year published on it. And so what this chart shows that the popularity of publishing these things have gone up and down. Different periods have different times. And remember, the IETF covers everything, not just the DNS. So the things from layer 2 and layer 3, routing, sometimes get more popular. Some applications like HTTP sometimes get more popular. And so you see more RFCs at different times about them. Aggregating it this way doesn't really show you much other than that we're still publishing a lot of RFCs every year. Get active in the IETF. You will probably only care about a narrow them. If you're a generalist, you've got a lot to cover. Some examples, these are RFCs that Russ had chosen that are sort of related to what we hear also in ICANN. And this is just a sampling. Like I said, there's over 100 RFCs that are really related to like DNS and addressing and such. RFC 1034 and RFC 1035 are the definition of how DNS works. You'll notice those are low numbers. They were published like before 1990. Pretty much, if you're a technologist in this area working the DNS, those two are the ones you care about. A little bit later, we put something about how the DNS itself, how the system works, how does delegation work, what are root name servers and such like that. A little bit later than that, RFC 2826. So some RFCs are actually written by the IAB, and I'll describe the IAB, the Internet Architecture Board, in a little bit. They're sort of the overall architecture folks, and one of the things that, as you know, or hopefully you know, coming to an ICANN meeting, is that the DNS, you can only have really one DNS. Two people can't both say that they are responsible for COM or something like that. So this was a statement from the IAB calling for a unique DNS root. And that was because at the time there were some people who were saying, oh, we can have roots. Makes sense from a business standpoint if you want to break the internet up into small little chunks, but it doesn't make sense. So the IAB came out and said, no, this is how we believe that this should be working. So notice in this list you have technical specifications. You also have procedural specifications. I'll just zip through the others. WHOIS is a separate protocol from the DNS. DNSSEC came later. Now notice that DNSSEC came way later than domain names. And those three RFCs are dense, but interesting to some people. Internationalized domain names came later. Now we had a cut about international, had a first round of international domain names actually between WHOIS and the DNSSEC ones. The ones settled on later, the second round, which came in about 2010, are the ones that you see here. And again, I want to note, internationalized domain names have not always been around. Quite a while for us to be able to figure out how were we going to do. In fact, serious work didn't even start on it until approximately the year 2000. And then it took a few more years for the first cut and another almost 7 years for the second cut. And RDAP is a recent WHOIS. Another procedural one is Principles of Operation of the IANA Registries, and that's something for those of you who are following transition, that's a fairly important RFC. And the last one that Russ threw on here is HTTP, just as a reminder that we do a lot of stuff other than HTTP, the things on the web, people care about a lot. And so HTTP 1 would have been RFC maybe 1,000 or so. So it took that long to get HTTP2. So let's go back. I'm going to skip over this mostly just to, this is a recap of some earlier slides. Why is the IETF doing what it wants to do? Really the most important thing out of here is The IETF is about one internet. Doesn't have to be an internet that agrees with each other. In fact, it's very easy to disagree with each other. But technically, if you want to have universal communication, you need to have a set of rules that people voluntarily follow. No one is forced to follow these. But if they don't follow them, they're not going to be part of the internet. But a set of rules that everyone can follow. And how do we do that? What is the way to do that? And really, the bold at the bottom, the rough consensus and running code really is what we're concerned with. Earlier about that the IETF has three meetings a year. Notice that two things on this. One, that the most I've ever had an IETF meeting was 2,800, and ICANN meetings typically have that many or more. So IETF meetings are smaller than ICANN meetings. Other thing to notice is it's pretty much stabilized, and the numbers over the last, say, the number is significantly lower than what you get in an ICANN meeting. So 1,200 is what we typically get. Like ICANN, or actually ICANN did it like the IETF, of that they meet in different continents each time, try to get around. IETF is not, for their face-to-face meetings, is not as aggressive as ICANN at meeting in far-flung countries, because it seems like people are more funded to come to ICANN meetings than they are to IETF meetings. So IETF pretty much normally meets in North America, Europe, Asia, each year that way. We've never had a meeting south of the equator. We're going to have one here in Buenos Aires. But basically, and North America used to be U.S. because that was easy for everyone to get to until the U.S. State Department made it hard for a lot of people to get to. So now North America, most often not the U.S. The U.S. State Department just started making things really hard for a lot of people to get visas easily, and the Canadians didn't. So we meet in Vancouver a lot. This is, again, now when we say 1,200 people show up, that's probably less than a third of the active IETF participants, really, that don't come to meetings, who are still doing very good work. So regardless of meetings, when does the IETF sort of pick up stuff? Because it's the internet. It could be anything. Well, the IETF really tries to look at solving problems. Its engineers are the kind of people who like to solve problems. There's always problems. The question is, when does a problem need to be solved by a policy of an engineering solution? And that's sort of a tough call. The longer that the internet has existed, the more things, the policy. IETF tends to take on things where we can scope it fairly well. The IETF tends not to take on things saying, oh, let's fix voice communication. Somebody says, we want to do voice communication sort of in this style. That's the kind of thing that the IETF would take on more. There has to be an agreement of when we finish. So unlike CERTs, the IETF likes to close off working groups when the work is done, especially if the work is being done by people who really are going to try to come to the meetings. They don't want to come to meetings for the rest of their lives. They would like to have a feeling that the work is going to get done. Finished. So part of the scope is knowing when you can be done. Now, I grant you the IETF fails miserably at that sometimes, and there are working groups that have lasted for 10 or 15 years. But when those working groups get closed, usually there's a lot of cheering and things like that. So we're getting better these days at actually coming up with work items that can be closed as part of the scope. And maybe it needs to get reopened again 3 years later when people are using a protocol. But generally, things are supposed to get closed. Sometimes work comes to the IETF from other standards organizations. So nobody 20 years ago would have thought that the IETF would be the premier. There are many other standards organizations that are much better funded, that have closed membership and such like that, who think, well, we've got all this money, you know, we've got more meetings, you know, we meet in nicer locations. This was, you know, where the work will be done. But it turns out that open sort of won. Some of those organizations are going out of business, and on their way out of business, they hand all their work to the IETF. And the IETF sometimes says, no, that's not interesting to us. The reason you're going out of business is you didn't really pay. Sometimes that kind of work from other standards organizations over, and it's actually very useful. So, for example, the W3C, the PEEP web standards, they're still around and such like that. Sometimes the IETF and the W3C will work together. Sometimes the IETF will take on work, you know, it'll start in the IETF. W3C says, you know what, we think we would be better at that. And if the IETF agrees, it's like, great, we don't need to have that. The IETF is not out. We're looking for problems that need to be solved. Conversely, some work will start in, like, the IEEE or in W. They'll say, we started this, but it's now feeling very internet-y. You take it over. Sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes the answer is no. And then the work dies. Sometimes interest groups come to the IETF and say, we would like you to start doing this. These are policy groups. We'll get privacy groups at least once a year. The internet doesn't have the right amount of privacy. You should fix this. And usually the response is, well, we've worked